Hello, and welcome to the Panzer Podcast. My name is John Burgess, and I will be your host today as we deep dive into all things tanks. First of all, I received a rather interesting email this morning. Well, this morning as of when I first started writing this episode on October 21st. I couldn't believe what I was reading. And then I did a little bit of my famous turkey math. Folks, it has been a year to the day since the release of the very first episode of the very first series of the very first Panzer Podcast. And I can't thank you all more for tuning in and listening all this time. You guys are truly fucking awesome, so thank you very much. Secondly, I do wish to apologize about releasing episode 205 a week late. My voice was trashed, just like the Dodgers offense. I'm only half kidding. I love me some Dodgers, win or lose. Go Dodgers. Anyway, my voice, as you might have been able to tell, is fine. Right? Tell me it's okay, please. Okay, we're entering some territory that some of you might recognize if you have ever participated in the US tech tree of a particular game where war is part of the name, and the other part of the name is the sound that follows lightning. Okay, it's War Thunder. I'm sure World of Tanks probably covers this as well, but I don't personally play that game. Anyway, on today's episode, we are going to dissect the medium tank M2, which, if you'll recall, is what the prototype T5 Phase 1 was standardized as. The T5E1, the T5E2, the Phase 2, and the Phase 3 were all prototype vehicles and were not the standard variants like the T5 Phase 1. Instead, they were used to try out some things that might help with further innovations. The M2, on the other hand, was what the Ordnance Department had decided would furnish the U.S. Army with its new breed of medium tanks. So let's dive in. What actually comes with standardization? Well, of course, one might assume with standardization comes modernization, and perhaps the end of the prototype and tinkering phase? Well, I think we all know that is some BS, considering all of the variants of every armored fighting vehicle of the Second World War. The U.S. Ordnance Department notwithstanding. Realistically, once a vehicle had been accepted for standardization, things like the engine, main gun, armor plates, and consequently the weight of the vehicle, tend to be increased a little bit, or improved upon. No longer is the vehicle going to be made of soft, mild steel. No, instead, these are fighting vehicles deemed fit for frontline duty. As far as the visual components, the medium tank M2 looks basically the same as the T5 Phase 1 did. You know, it had the VVSS suspension, the fixed forward machine guns, the sponson rotor turreted machine guns, the centerline driver's seat cockpit. Again, virtually identical. Hell, even the cooling fins on the final drive housing were going to remain on the M2. They still weren't really satisfied with the temperature regulation of the final drive, so that was the fix. However, if we scratch below the veneer and dig a little bit deeper into the vehicle, there are some less subtle changes that have been incorporated. First of all, let's take a look at that armor plate. We have dispensed with the prototype mild steel, the lighter armor, but what does that really mean for the M2 medium? Quote, the hull and turret were assembled from face-hardened armored plate using structural steel angles and nickel steel rivets. End quote. Thank you, Mr. Honeycutt. We have previously discussed the different styles of armor which were available during the 1930s through the 1940s. Circle back to episode 002 of the Panther series For those of you who wish to get a better lesson on rolled homogeneous armor versus cast armor versus riveted. Trust me, it's, dare I say it, riveting? Okay. Since we're talking a bit more about riveted armored plates, let's focus a bit on what that entails. For those curious, riveted armor is accomplished simply by the process of bolting or riveting smaller armored plates together on a skeleton or frame to form a singular armored structure, like a tank. In this case, Mr. Honeycutt so brilliantly laid before us that the U.S. armored industry was using face-hardened plates. Once again, face-hardening was the process of taking your metal object and applying, usually, some sort of heat treatment to the outer face of the object, which then creates a thin layer of hardened metal, thus face-hardened. The process can be quite complex and a little bit time-consuming. Heat treatment during this period of time wasn't as advanced as the process might be by today's standards, but the principles remain mostly the same. By quickly applying heat to a metal object and rapidly cooling or quenching, usually with water, sometimes with oil, creates a layer of martensite on the surface. Martensite? Wait a minute. Wasn't that the ugly bastard that was mucking up the late war German armor? Almost. But no, that was actually bainite, which forms much like martensite, but is usually less desirable and during this period of time was certainly unintentional. However, that was only as problematic for the German armored industry because the bainite was actually forming within the layers of armor and not on the outside. And again, not on purpose. But really, face hardening only applies this thin layer of martensite to the face or outer layer of the armored plate, leaving below the surface, again, when I say softer, I don't actually mean like a pillow, but softer than the face-hardened material would be below the surface, which again is a much more malleable steel, which allows the plate to flex. Now, some of you are asking, why would you want flex in your armored plate? Why not harden the whole damn thing through and through and defeat enemy missiles with pure uber strength? Well, just like cracking open an egg shell or, you know, a Panther turret with a large HE round, when the steel becomes too brittle or hard or full of bainite because your raw material input is garbage, the armor loses its effectiveness. There is a bit of a curious dance which takes place within the metallurgy of armor. You want, and I mean really, you need, a hardened outside, which can both help deflect, deform, and even shatter incoming rounds, especially early war armor-piercing rounds, which were much more of a solid shot than the later heat rounds or other purpose-built armor-defeating anti-tank rounds, such as shaped charges. So what that means, underneath this hardened steel, you want a much softer or malleable underbelly, which allows the armor to flex. You really don't want the armor to be hard all the way through for fear of the dreaded spalling effect. Quote, spalling is best described as metal fragments that have been broken off of the armor after an impact and acts like shrapnel. This is especially alarming considering human beings are bags of squishy flesh. End quote. Thank you, Panzer Podcast, episode 002. I've always wanted to quote myself. So meta. But really, armor needs to be balanced in both flexibility as well as hardness. A fine line. Or, like the Germans and Soviets, and even the Allies on particular projects, if you make the armor thick enough, you don't really give a shit how hard it is. That's a blasé statement, but that is kind of, sort of, one of the theories that was put into practice. More on that later. But for now, let's keep it continental. Or North American, that is. Face hardening was notably an early war phenom. Smaller tanks with smaller, thinner armored plates could bolster their hardness and thus the capabilities of the armor by using this technique. Notably, face hardening becomes much more difficult once the armor plate becomes larger. When there is more surface area of the plate, it could, and oftentimes would, deform, shatter, or otherwise become compromised when face hardening application was applied. A smaller plate, which is going to be riveted onto a frame, could thus be face hardened more reliably and uniformly. So, what does this mean for our medium tank M2? Using the face hardening method, the armor plate thickness was now 1 1/8 inch thick, or 28.5 millimeters thick. On front-facing portions of the vehicle, especially, although it would taper down to about 1/4 inch thick on the floor plates, about 6 millimeters thick. Okay, so now 1 1/8 inch is just a little bit thinner than the 1 7/16 inch of the T5 Phase 1, that being 28.5 millimeters to 36.5 millimeters. However, due to the face hardening aspects, this 5/16 inch difference, about 8 millimeters, was deemed acceptable. And remember, weight was still a concern here. Riveted armor adds up quickly in that department. Armored plates, steel frame, and rivets all contribute to the heft of the vehicle. So having a thinner but more hardened plate just plain makes sense. Last episode, we briefly touched on the 9-cylinder Wright air-cooled radial R975 350 horsepower engine. You guys totally remember that one, right? Well, it was the engine that the Ordnance Department had decided to drop into the T5 Phase 3 for testing. And well, like we had previously discussed, was quite successful. So this engine replaced the earlier T5 Phase 1 engine, which was notably underpowered for a medium tank. It was also the same engine used in the M2 light tank. So with this new Wright engine, combined with the armor and the 37mm M3 high-velocity cannon, contributed to the now fully loaded weight of 19 tons for the M2 medium tank. Despite the increased weight, the power-to-weight ratio was still exceedingly well-received at 18.4 horsepower per ton, which moved the tank along at a maximum speed of 26 miles per hour, or 41 kilometers per hour, a speed which was nominally achieved in fifth gear only, which meant on a flat road, no turning, no obstacles. Basically, you had to drive this thing on a drag strip. Otherwise, you probably weren't going to reach 26 miles an hour. You know, watch out, speed demons. However, the ground pressure of the vehicle steeply rose to 18.8 pounds per square inch due to the 13 1/4 inch wide tracks, or about 33.5 centimeters. This was actually quite awful in terms of ground pressure. The wider 16-inch, or 40.5 centimeters, which were the tracks on the T5 Phase 3, hadn't been fully incorporated on the M2. Before I let this information just kind of wash over us, keep this in mind with the ground pressure. I may be a fanboy of the Sherman, but I will not let the detractable features remain out of sight or out of mind. This ground pressure issue would dog the M2, and ultimately, even the M4, throughout its lifespan. Remember, the 45.5-ton Panther had a ground pressure of 12.5 psi. This 19-ton M2 had 18.8 psi. For the fiscal year of 1939, funds had been appropriated for construction of 18 M2 medium tanks. So, basically, a company of tanks? With production beginning in the summer of 1939, the second M2 medium tank would not be delivered to Aberdeen until August of 1939, which they were doing so for further testing. Another 54 of the M2 medium tanks were ordered initially. However, as 1939 quickly was turning into 1940, the situation in Europe was turning into a veritable shit show, which would essentially put the kibosh on the M2 whilst simultaneously igniting the medium tank M2A1 project. And before we move on to the next iteration, of the 18 produced, there are actually still some surviving examples. I can tell you for sure one of them is at Fort Benning with the Armor and Cav Museum there, as well as another example at Aberdeen. And I could be mistaken, but I believe Fort Lee, Virginia should still have one. It may have actually been moved to Fort Benning for restoration, so don't quote me on that, but if you're ever around any of those places of the armored Holy Land, you should go take a gander and then send me some pics. Anyway, it feels redundant to have to repeat this, but as ever, the Ordnance Department and Infantry both found that the M2 needed a little more oomph, a little more sauce, and the recipe for that gravy was, of course, the need for more armor protection and engine power. Designs of an upgraded M2 were well underway by early 1940, once the European situation began to unravel. And so, the M2A1 was born out of necessity more than anything. The growing American sentiment in the military, that was, at some point, this war in Europe was gonna spill over. The army, they weren't blind. They had seen the reports of German armor, British armor, Italian armor. Even Czech and Soviet stuff would have been, I don't know if common knowledge is the right term here, but the folks in the Ordnance Department, they would have a reason to want to know as much as possible about the other nations' tanks if they could get their hands on it. Quote, "The most obvious change was a roomier turret with vertical sides replacing the sloped walls of the M2 turret. Pistol ports were installed in the turret sides and the door on the rear was removed." End quote. According to Mr. Honeycutt, and of course my own two eyes, these are quite noticeable changes in the outward look for the M2A1. A roomier turret is a big deal, considering once again that there were three men essentially working within the turret, the commander, the gunner, and the loader, along with the extra machine gunner that would have resided within the fighting compartment as well. Now, this isn't wholly born out of the idea of looking at German tanks or Russian tanks, but the idea that a larger turret was going to be needed was pretty apparent at this point to the Americans. The pistol ports on the M2A1 were a fantastic departure from the previous iteration of the, vision slits that were on the tank prior. These pistol ports will look familiar to anyone who has laid eyes on the M3 Grant, which is another medium tank, and spoiler alert, we'll be discussing the M3 Grant in an upcoming episode. These same pistol ports were even found on the early models of the M4 Sherman tanks. And now, I have been using the term vision slits for the prior models of the prototype tanks because that's what they were. Pistol ports, in this sense of the M2A1, served two purposes. They were, of course, protected vision slits, as well as now movable gun shields that could be opened and closed from within the turret, allowing, a crewman to stick his pistol out or the barrel of a submachine gun, or maybe even toss a grenade out while still maintaining some semblance of protection by being behind the now increased to 1¼-inch thick armor plate, about 32 millimeters thick. Removing the rear hatch allowed for yet another pistol port to be added, as well as removing a potential weak spot in the turret, you know, anytime you have a hatch like that, you know, not to say that, oh, you can aim for a hatch at 500 to 1,000 meters away, but if it got hit, would be weaker than the turret plate. So, more or less, the M2A1 is every bit the successor of the M2, both in appearance and armament. We are still rocking with all the machine guns, though I will add an improved tubular sight and an additional shield was added to each one of the rotor machine guns, increasing both the protection of the gun, the optics, and, probably most importantly, the operator. It also made shooting easier and more effective with a wider field of view. Additionally, the same M3 37mm high velocity cannon, which, worth mentioning here, was the same cannon that the infantry used as their anti-tank gun and would do so throughout the war. Caveat, by 1942, it was realized just how ineffective the 37mm was against German armor. But as an infantry support weapon, it was still quite useful. And if you happened to find yourself fighting against the Japanese tanks, it was always effective. The M3 was actually based off of the German PAK-36 gun, of which two were acquired and studied. The M3 itself was mounted on a carriage with tires towards the front, flanking the thin gunner shield. And this shield was basically for shrapnel and small arms fire only. Anything else fired by like a tank or an artillery piece was going straight through this thing and cutting it up like Swiss cheese. To better balance itself by adding two legs of about 12 feet in length or 3.5 meters, which could be opened up or unlimbered to increase support and stability. Conversely, these same two legs could also be closed up or limbered to be pulled or towed away to another position. The ubiquitous U.S. Army truck, quarter ton, 4x4 command reconnaissance vehicle, was a perfect fit to tow this weapon, which you all might know this vehicle by its better known name as the Willys MB or the Ford GPW. And if that doesn't give it away, it is probably best known simply as the Jeep. I might have to do a special episode focusing on the Jeep itself. I know it's not really an armored vehicle, but the testing phase was quite interesting and actually kind of deadly for some unfortunate GIs. But that is a story for another time. The M3 anti-tank gun also holds the title as the first anti-tank gun in the United States Armory, so yay for that. Returning to the M2A1, I mentioned the 37mm cannon because while it is still the same cannon as that of the M2, a new mount had been designed and was fitted to the new and improved M2A1 medium tank. The new gun mount was known as the M19. It provided much more armor and protection, not only for the barrel, but for the recoil mechanism as well. Essentially, the Ordnance Department had designed an armored sleeve that was installed over the barrel and replaced the previous mantle. So yes, the M2A1 had an M3 cradled in an M19. This will never not be funny to me. I know nomenclature is probably not everyone's go-to for comedic relief, but here we are. Before we look internally at some of the changes made to the power plant, I want to touch on the last bit of visual differences, which was both practical as well as visually odd. The downsloping upper glacis of the M2A1, which now had three horizontal steel angles attached to the front plate. These angles were installed as defensive countermeasures against bullet splash. So you had one on the very bottom that ran the length of the front-facing plate. You had one, maybe like a foot above it, also running the length of the width. And then finally, near the top, there was another one towards the smaller end of the trapezoid. So these were installed as, like I said, countermeasures against bullet splash. So bear in mind, yes, while buttoned up safely inside your tank, you are virtually impervious to things like small arms fire. However, not all of the components of a tank which reside outside of the armored shell were safe. Things like the barrels of the fixed frontal machine guns, for example, could be damaged by things like incoming rifle or machine gun rounds. Not to mention the very nature of the sloped glacis itself created a sort of ramp that could, upon impact, deflect a round up towards the driver's position. I wouldn't exactly call it a shot trap by definition, but these angles were in the same vein and effort as what was on the Panther Alf's G, remember that chin mantlet, which was installed to defeat the inherent shot trap which was created by the C-shaped Panther mantlet. So bear in mind that these bullet splash guards, this is not the last time we will be discussing them, as they kind of show up in later iterations of American tanks. Alright, let us now turn to the internals. What have we got in these guts that makes the M2A1 that much different and hopefully better? First and foremost, we know the Army wanted more speed along with more armor. What is something that usually suffers once more armor and thus more weight is added? Just ask anybody who happened to have rolled around in those up-armored Humvees during the Global War on Terror, and you'll probably hear a lot of complaints about maintenance and poor gas mileage. No, I'm kidding. Well, not about the maintenance or gas mileage, but it ain't your money that pays for that JP8 and the new suspension. Anyway, it's speed. Speed always suffers when you add more weight. To combat this, the Wright-manufactured R975 EC2 engine, which, again, that was what was put in the M2 medium tank, was now upgraded on the M2A1 with a nice little supercharger, which increased the horsepower from 350 to 400 at 24 RPMs. Even with the newly increased weight of 21 tons, the power-to-weight ratio was still quite high at 19 horsepowers per ton. This 50 horsepower difference was enough to maintain the maximum speed of 26 miles per hour, or 42 kilometers per hour. Same as the M2. Furthermore, track width was also increased by 1 full inch to 14.25 inches wide, or 36 centimeters, which lowered the ground pressure considerably to 15.3 psi. Quite the improvement over the lighter M2 medium tank, which was carrying about with an 18.8 psi on those 13.25 inch wide tracks, or 33.5 centimeters. The fine folks at the Aberdeen Proving Ground and Fort Benning were learning, but without practical combat experience, all of this tinkering was still hypothetical. Though improvements would continue to be made, a hydraulic system was fitted to the differential steering system, which helped improve maneuverability and reduce the overall effort needed to steer the tank, along with an improved fuel system to boot, which improved fuel consumption and maintained operation for longer with fewer mechanical breakdowns. Quote, "We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I can say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny, never surpassed in the dark, lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy." End quote. Sir Winston Churchill before the House of Commons on May 13, 1940. Of course, this was his first speech as Prime Minister after taking over from Neville Chamberlain. This was a tumultuous time for everyone, but especially the Allies. And that is to say, France and Britain, they were the lone superpowers who stood alongside the Low Countries to defend against Hitler's invasion of the West. Belgium would fall in 18 days, the Netherlands in a week, Luxembourg hardly survived the day. And by June 25th of 1940, France herself would capitulate. One of Europe's finest military powers would surrender to Hitler and his Nazi invaders. Finally, this left Britain alone and clearly in dire need of allies and support. This is the story that we've all heard thousands of times. Some of you probably even more. I don't know how many documentaries you've rerun or books you're currently reading. My point is, the war was now in full effect for the would-be Western allies. Except for one crucial future partner, spoiler alert, America. Well, obviously. There has been trading, some lend-lease, and, maybe FDR sent some old, out-of-date destroyers under the guise of, whatever. The point is, officially, the United States was not at war with anybody. Nor was she properly allied to anyone either. Kind of a tight spot to be in. Without tipping your hand too much by fully mobilizing. And remember, to mobilize your country is very expensive. And in 1940, the American economy was still suffering those lingering effects of the Great Depression. Mind you, it was getting better all the time. Better, better, all the time. Thanks to some of the New Deal programs and just general economic recovery efforts that were beginning to bear fruit. But that still left the Army and the Ordnance Department wanting for funds to produce both tanks and make them better. And after watching their chummy pals in France get essentially steamrolled and damn near humiliated at places like Dunkirk, the U.S. Ordnance Department was well aware of the challenges they might face with the current stock of armored fighting vehicles. Even with the newly slated M2A1 medium tank set to overtake the M2 as the new standard for the U.S., the writing was on the walls, the floors, the ceilings, even the back of their eyelids. The Ordnance Department, the people working there, they knew the United States needed something bigger and better. What that ultimately looked like? Well, they needed to get moving on production of what they had first before trying to figure out what better even looked like. The brilliant minds within the Army had been thoroughly studying the Blitzkrieg, or lightning warfare tactics, used by the Germans. Essentially, the armored thrust. There has probably been as many experts on the matter as there are definitions of what a blitzkrieg is, or should be, or was, or whatever. I'm not here to redesign the sprocket, but I do enjoy the spirit of the Oxford definition. Quote, an intense military campaign intended to bring about a swift victory. End quote. Okay, that's a pretty simple concept. And essentially, really, it just means you're bringing to bear as much concentration of force in a single point. The German word was, or is, Schwerpunkt, which is one of those fun German compound words, schwer for heavy or focus, depending on how you're using it, and Punkt meaning point. So the main focus, the primary point, the heavy point, you get it, right? Okay. The point is, get it? That essentially, you want to bring as much bang-bang to the enemy as possible to overwhelm them and break into the rear of their lines. On the most basic level, in a very perfect vacuum, the intended Schwerpunkt would be overwhelmed by your best and most maneuverable crack troops, again armed with the latest and greatest equipment. In 1939, that meant mobilized, mechanized, and armored troops working in close concert with lots of artillery and your close air support. Following the inevitable breakthrough, the now incredibly mobile armored and mechanized forces would pour into the rear of the enemy, hopefully disrupting communications, logistics, and ultimately, in a perfect world, breaking the defenders' morale and forcing them to either withdraw or surrender. Once the breakthrough had been established, the less mobile forces, which would be your reserves, would push through the gap and solidify the foothold, now flanking the enemy and threatening an encirclement. This is how a blitzkrieg ought to work, and in a vacuum, that's perfect. But once again, we'll need to remember that the enemy always gets a vote. However, these tactics would remain in use throughout the war, though ultimately a pretty good counter to this would be the defense in depth. Remember Kursk. So it wasn't always going to be successful, and it wasn't always going to be done in the same way. I know we're probably all thinking, can this fucking guy go one episode without using German shit? Probably not. Anyway, I bring all of this up because in May of 1940, which is where we've left our story off, the American Armored Forces were still considered part of the infantry force, and the tactics the Americans practiced were that of the infantry support tank, very much so like the British and French doctrine of the time. Again, I am no expert on the British and French tank doctrine, but for a real quick and dirty primer, instead of focusing their armored units onto a single point, the theory was to spread out the armored vehicles amongst the infantry to provide support in a very even manner. Honestly, having just fought the most broad front war the world had ever seen only 20 years prior, this wasn't a bad conclusion that the defensively minded French and British armored theorists had come up with. Assuming that the next war would be fought in similar fashion to the previous one, and before anyone comes at me, by 1918, maneuver warfare and small unit tactics were becoming much more commonplace. That much I am aware. However, broad front strategies were still holding the main lines as offensive operations took place within smaller sectors in which those small unit tactics and breakthrough attempts would be used. What I mean by fighting the previous war was that a broad front along the French and German border was expected. You don't believe me? Just look up the Maginot Line. So, with these two styles, I'm sure, you know, there's a little bit more nuance than that, but let's just say there's two. The United States still did not even have dedicated armored divisions or even battalions. Instead, the armored infantry units would be spread throughout an infantry division. By studying the success of the German panzer divisions, they would need to change. And on July 10th, 1940, the formation of the U.S. Armored Force, led by none other than the father of U.S. Armored Forces himself, Major General Adnah R. Chaffee, Jr. While, of course, hailed as the father of U.S. Armor, Chaffee was actually a cavalry commander who was intensely interested and invigorated by the idea of mechanized and armored warfare. It's almost cliche to speak about cavalry commanders during the dawn of the tank, because most of the time, you'll read about Sir Reginald so-and-so and his distaste for the cowardice of a man writing about some iron machination, rather than bearing his breastplate to the onslaught of fully automatic rifle fire. John Taylor, in his book Deborah and the War of the Tanks, 1917, describes a scene during the Battle of Cambrai in which cavalry units were observing the British Mark IV tanks advancing toward the Boche lines. Quote, "On the one hand, contempt was too strong a word, but the cavalry had hardly covered themselves in glory. In this sense, Cambrai could be seen as the death of the cavalry, though fortunately in metaphorical terms only." End quote. What I like about this little excerpt is that the man is describing more or less the evolution of cavalry. Sure, the horse in combat was basically being phased out. The last U.S. cavalry charge took place, I believe, in the Philippines in the Pacific Theater in 1942. But we'll just say that horses after World War I basically done being combat units. What Chaffee, unlike many of his contemporaries, might have you think is that cavalry tactics were not dead. The cavalryman just had to evolve with the times. His horse was now armored, tracked, and had a complement of crew to operate. Quote, "The First World War ended into the rubble of British and French tanks clawing their way through the mud of France and Belgium in November of 1918. The Second World War began with the clatter of German tank tracks moving rapidly across the plains of Poland in September of 1939. End quote. Thank you, Mr. John T. Broome, from his wonderful book, The Commander's Vision in Blue and Gray, The Roles of Adna Chaffee Jr., James Wilson, and the American Civil War in the Development of American Armored Doctrine. Quite the title, and quite the authority on Chaffee and his role with the creation of the U.S. Armored Forces. And I think the best way to describe Chaffee's mentality regarding the makeup of armored forces is in his speech which he gave to the War Department just 1 month prior to being given command of the first two armored divisions. Quote, "We have a directive to consider the organization of two armored divisions and how we can get them. And speed is essential. We have got to do it now. That means that we must make use, in starting the organization of these two divisions, of what we have and go forward from that as the material comes in. Cavalry contributes everything it has, infantry everything it has. We must not stop and haggle over a lot of details and figure out a lot of things that have been studied over and over again by boards and commanding officers in the field, and tested these maneuvers in time and again." End quote. So I think we're going to have to get a little bit more into people like Chaffee, George Marshall, Patton, Frank Andrews, and several others of the top brass of the U.S. Army during these pre-war and interwar periods. Some of the behind-the-scenes people who helped shape the actual armored doctrine, which is something we're going to have to do once we get into the tactics and combat deployment phase of this series. We've gone over the what and the where, but the who, which is just as important, will need its own episode, or maybe two, to cover properly. But for now, know that the cavalryman, Chaffee, was in the background for many, many years. Especially true very early on, in 1934, Chaffee was actually the budget and legislative coordinator until 1938. Some of those very desperate and very formative years of the armored force, Chaffee understood that the armored force needed to be independent of both the infantry and cavalry. This was necessary for the aggressive, offensive-oriented doctrine that was going to be, as we shall see, the successful route in using armor. Okay, I think we've set the scene. We have our top man, we have our newly formed independent armored force, we have our tank. You know, remember the M2A1? This was the U.S. answer to the medium tank question. And they were ready to start creating some proper armor divisions. Even in July of 1940, unfortunately, the two armor divisions, and there was one separate tank battalion created, had only a total of 400 tanks to choose from to fill those ranks. And unfortunately, only 18 of them were considered modern, which were the 18 M2 medium tanks. Hardly an impressive force. At this point in time, there was only one production facility, which resided at Rock Island Armory. If we'll recall, when Christie was still sniffing around, we had his facilities at Hoboken as well. But that was almost 15 years ago, and Christie had been snubbed. Not to mention those facilities, even at their maximum capacity, were still basically just like a cottage industry. Now, I'm sure you've all seen the memes, Detroit Auto Industry versus the Axis. Which is, it's kind of reductive in a lot of ways. Yeah, okay. America's production output dwarfed every single Axis power, and for what it's worth, even the Allies couldn't compete with American production. Though it wasn't like that from the get-go. There wasn't just some magical button that turned the Studebaker, Ford, and General Motors plants into tank factories. It wasn't going to be that easy. Obviously, some pre-planning had already been laid down, and maybe for some of you this won't come as a surprise, but the first plans for production on the scale that was going to be required to produce an effective amount of armor was the locomotive industry. First of all, they have quite a bit of experience with heavy equipment and forging, casting, and welding large and heavy pieces of metal together. This was an obvious choice, as a lot of that knowledge could and would transfer over to tank production. However, when one thinks of locomotives, we probably don't think of mass production. I mean, how many trains could there possibly be in this country at one time? I don't actually have the answer to that rhetorical question, but the answer to the mass production question actually lies within the cosmopolitan Motor City known as Detroit. After all, the automobile industry had seemingly solved the equation to mass production. And realistically, it was just a matter of retooling the factories and switching them from civilian production to wartime production. Which, that makes it sound like, yeah, we just switch it over, no big deal. But there's actually a lot more to it. So enter our probably unknown hero, a Mr. William S. Knudsen, formerly the president of General Fucking Motors. Ever heard of him? Okay, kidding aside. Knudsen was appointed on the 29th of May, 1940, to essentially fill the role that Albert Speer was doing in Nazi Germany. Knudsen was now the head of military production for the United States. Just to shed a little bit of light as to who Mr. Knudsen was, as I like to do, besides being the head of military production, the dude was born in Copenhagen in 1879 and made his way to America by the year 1900. He worked at a small auto parts manufacturer where in 1911, none other than Henry Ford himself purchased and folded the company into his burgeoning Ford Motor Company. This is where Knudsen would envision streamlining the practices within Ford and helped reorganize the company's production facilities until 1921, when Knudsen resigned due to Henry Ford being a complete controlling dickhead. However, it didn't take very long when in February of 1922, Knudsen was hired by General Motors. Thanks to Mr. Alfred Sloan Jr., Knudsen came into his own here and revolutionized the entire automobile industry in a big way. In David Hushnell's book, From the American System to Mass Production, 1800 to 1932, The Development of Manufacturing Technology in the United States. Yes, I know these book titles are just so intensely riveting. But he describes just how intense the changeover, as it was known, was for the automobile industry. Quote, within weeks, GM's president, Pierre Dupont, who had just taken over command of the Chevrolet division, named Knudsen vice president in charge of operations. End quote. Without skipping a beat, Knudsen revolutionized the GM plants and specifically the Chevrolet division. Without deep diving too much into the auto industry of the 1920s and explaining every little bit of minutia that made mass production of the automobile not only feasible and successful, but I'll leave it to Knudsen to describe how he did it. Quote, by getting all noses pointed in the same direction. End quote. Thanks, Knudsen. What that actually looked like was using new machine tool practices, modernizing the vehicles, the production method, and scrutinizing the raw material purchased while installing new heavy machines, and here's the kicker, which were not single purpose. This last bit, single purpose manufacturing machines, is what ultimately killed the Model T and caused quite a dip in Ford's production and overall monopoly of the market. And also, kind of why Knudsen left. So these new multi-purpose machines could be readily, and you know, that's somewhat quickly, changed over from one model of vehicle to another. And because the machines themselves were fitted with better quality control and inspection mechanisms, the margin for error was slim and getting slimmer. Knudsen had figured out the ingredients. In 1924, Chevrolet produced 280,000 automobiles. In 1928, they produced over 1 million. And the very next year, Chevrolet began producing six-cylinder automobiles, which was a departure from the standard four-cylinder automobiles that they had been producing for the last decade. But because of Knudsen's retooling and reorganization efforts, the next year they switched over, Chevrolet produced 1.5 million brand new six-cylinder automobiles. This is a big deal. Even with retooling and producing something brand new to the company, they didn't have a drop-off. They didn't see a dip in production. They increased their production by 500,000. That's not nothing. And FDR and the War Department recognized this. So they poached Mr. Knudsen from the automobile industry at Bernard Baruch's recommendation to lead the United States into its rearmament program of 1940. I'm at a loss of words. I'm not sure how else to put this, other than without Mr. Knudsen, the entire prosecution of the Second World War by the United States looks completely different. How different? I don't know. I can't tell you. I don't really like the what-if game, because we can't know. What we know is what happened. But I'm telling you right now, it's vastly different. I assure you, this decision is monumental to have Mr. Knudsen take over. And it's something that I think should be discussed more than just like a string of battles and victories. Because without this one man in the position that he was placed, the business of war production might have left the United States in quite a tight spot. Now, owing to the geographical anomaly that is the city of Detroit, the automobile industry also, kind of serendipitously, was fairly well contained in a large and capable area. You had the workforce was already there, the tools, the people, the space, the factories, even the logistical network that was there to provide raw materials for the auto industry already existed. In a lot of ways, this centralized production was perfect. It might have also made a perfect bombing target had any of the belligerents been able to reach it. Something else to keep in mind, American production never had to contend with, 1,000-pound bombs being airmailed directly into your home. So that also kind of helps with the mass production. Knudsen himself, being a man of action, phoned up the president of Chrysler, a one Mr. K.T. Keller, which, little side note, I love the idea of these old-timey dudes just going by initials. I might try it out. J.R. Burgess, at your service. Anyway, Knudsen rang up his homeboy from the auto industry and quickly arranged a meeting, where, not skipping a beat, he just flat out asked KT, "Hey, is Chrysler up to the task of producing medium tanks for the U.S. Army?" To which they accepted. I'm sure the meeting or the phone call went a little differently, but mind you, not a single person from Chrysler had even seen the M2A1. But they were confident that they could do it. Was it automobile hubris? No. The dudes from Chrysler, they knew what the hell they were doing, and they wasted no time and went straight to Rock Island Armory, where they observed the construction of only 3 brand new M2A1 medium tanks, where they sat down with the engineers. They drew up a full set of blueprints, which ended up weighing 186 pounds, or 84 kilos. Assuming a ream of plotter paper weighs anywhere between like 13 to 28 pounds or 6 to 13 kilos, that's a lot of blueprint paper. But again, these men were being thorough and did not, apparently, wish to have to come back and take more notes. So, for those of you keeping track at home, Knudsen was appointed head of production on May 29th, 1940. Chaffee made his June 10th speech about the creation of the armored force, and just a week later, on June 17th, the folks at Chrysler had their blueprints in hand for the M2A1 and were ready to start mapping out production before Chaffee had even been crowned head of the armored forces on July 10th. The speed in which this all happened is kind of remarkable, but also understandable. For every month, for every day, for every week, every moment that passed, Hitler was tightening the noose on Europe even further. So after some changes here, a little cost-cutting implementations there, this core group of engineers, sitting high atop the top floor of the Dodge Conant Avenue building in Detroit, had figured out how much land, buildings, and machine tools would be required to undertake the mass production of the M2A1 medium tank. On August 15th of 1940, Chrysler officially received and accepted the contract for 1,000 medium tank M2A1s to be delivered by August of 1942. Production levels, they were going to begin kind of low at about 3 per month for the first year and 100 per month after that until the contract was fulfilled. Quote, meanwhile, staff studies of intelligence reports from the fighting in Europe were concerned with the use by the Germans of the 75mm gun in the Panzer IV, end quote. General Chaffee, in a meeting with the Ordnance Department, determined that a 75mm gun was going to be paramount for any new medium tank before it could hit the battlefield. Almost instantly, this rendered the obsolescence of the M2A1 before a single production model has come out of Detroit. This happened only 13 days after the August 15th contract was awarded to Chrysler. Then it was canceled on August 28th, so 13 days, they didn't even have enough time to start building a tank. So plans were going to be quickly drawn up for a brand new medium tank, which would replace the M2A1, however, the new vehicle, which we will be discussing next time, would be built upon the M2A1 chassis, but that tank, known to history as the medium tank M3, will have to wait for the next episode. Well, folks, we're running a little bit long today, and that about wraps up the M2A1 and the beginning of the American automobile industry infiltrating our narrative, and finally showing up as the big bad mass producer that it was, or will be. So while the M2 and the M2A1 program met its fate before it could ever see combat, do not weep for it. For a smaller contract was retained for the Rock Island Armory facilities, who would produce about 94 M2A1s by August of 1941. These 94 vehicles, along with the 18 M2 medium tanks which were already produced, would be used, quite successfully I might add, as training vehicles for the newly minted armored forces, as well as being used for a little bit more experimenting. They toyed with the idea of adding a 3-inch or 76mm worth of armor as an applique. It was tossed around, though the additional 9,500 pounds or 4,300 kilos was not actually a great modification. It kind of weighed the tank down too much. Or my favorite, somewhat failed modification, was installing the E2 flamethrower instead of the 37mm M3 cannon. They tried this out on just one of the M2A1s, but finally, in 1942, both the M2 and the M2A1 medium tanks were officially declared obsolete by OCM 19099. Rest in peace, M2. Before we get out of here today, I do wish to say a big thank you to everyone who pre-ordered some stickers from the Panzer Shop. That's thepanzerpodcast.bigcartel.com. I'm sending in the order to the printer this afternoon, so expect a shipping notification within like a week or two. I was very surprised, happily, by the amount of support I received. So thanks again. You guys are all really fucking awesome. One more little housekeeping item. I will be releasing the next episode on time, but after that, we will be taking some time off as the holidays are coming up and I've got a little vacation time coming up, so I'm going to be gone. But don't worry, I will give you the hard details next episode when I know exactly what is going on and when. As always, I can be reached via email at thepanzerpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at thepanzerpod, and on Instagram at thepanzerpodcast, where I will be posting some photos of the things we talked about in today's episode. If you like what we're doing here, I would appreciate a positive review on Apple Podcast, on Spotify, or, you know, wherever you're listening, if possible, because it does help us reach new audience members, and I super appreciate it. I will also be updating in the show notes some additional sources today, as I went through quite a few books to get this episode written. Until next time, I'm John Burgess. Thanks for listening.